This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
So, Katie, last night I finally did that thing, that most European thing that I've been wanting to do for years. I boarded a train on the other side of the continent and woke up as if by magic this morning in my hometown of Amsterdam.
Oh, fun. Wait, was it fun?
Well, kind of. It's amazing. And I've been like watching as people on European Twitter talk about their wonderful night train journeys across the continent for a long time now, and finally did it. But I think because I was so excited about it, I didn't think about quite how uncomfortable it is.
They're very cramped.
Yeah, I was in a couchette with three people. So that's three bunks on top of each other. And there's not any room to stand or sit.
Top bunk is the worst. You have to have your neck at a right angle.
It was challenging. But I did get to sleep. And I realize I'm just a bit like a baby. Like when the transport is moving, when I'm being rocked, then I do actually sleep.
How lovely.
I highly recommend it, even if it's really uncomfortable.
And there is just something very romantic about it, isn't there? Although, as you say, in sort of the execution, I feel like the Europeans are light years behind Asia in terms of making it actually feel glam and fun. I took a Thai night train once and there were like little pockets for all of your stuff and everything was like really crisp and white. It was amazing. And I've taken multiple French ones, not the same experience.
Yeah, they could do with a little bit of sprucing up. Anyway, how's your week been, Katie?
Well, I had a pretty special, embarrassing misuse of my second language moment earlier today.
Oh, yeah, I read about it on Twitter. I love it.
So I had to ring up Orange, the mobile internet provider, and I was chatting to this very nice young man. And instead of asking him how many megabytes the internet speed would be, I asked him how many giant dicks it would be. So unfortunate.
What are the two words?
Megabyte in French is mégaoctet, and megabit means mega penis. I'm not proud of it, but I do think it is important to discuss these moments because they happen to all of us who speak second languages. Like, it's part of the joy and the agony of the whole thing.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people have been sharing similar stories of second language screw-ups on our Twitter account, which has been making me feel a whole lot better. So check those out if you want a good laugh, at Europeans Pod. But moving swiftly on, what are we talking about this week?
Well, coming up later on in the show, we're going to be speaking to Lisa Caruana Finkel, a Maltese reproductive justice researcher and activist. We chose to speak to Lisa today about Malta's incredibly strict abortion laws because of what was happening at the top of one of Europe's institutions. The European Parliament got a new president this week, the first Maltese person to lead an EU institution, and her name is Roberta Metsola, and she's had a pretty bumpy build-up to her election because many of the headlines about her election have focused on the fact that she herself has an anti-abortion stance, a stance that seems pretty surprising for a president of a European institution in 2022, but one that maybe isn't so surprising for people living in Malta. We're going to be speaking to Lisa about abortion in Malta and to ask her what it feels like for her as a reproductive rights activist seeing this anti-abortion politician climb to this position of President of the European Parliament later on in the show.
But first. Who's had a bad week, Dominic?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it's been a bad week for the Free University in Amsterdam after this investigation by the Dutch public broadcaster showed that one of their research departments, a department that's called the Cross-Cultural Human Rights Centre, has been receiving a ton of money over a number of years from a university in China with links to the ruling Communist Party. And now this news was particularly shocking due to the presence of certain professors on staff in this department in Amsterdam. And the news report outlined some quotes from particular professors who have said things in the past that seem to downplay human rights abuses by China.
What kind of things?
Well, the director of the department is a guy called Tom Swart, and he's a regular guest on Chinese state television. And
well, he's a good sign.
Yeah. And he said things that were described in the Dutch reporting by an expert as music to the ears of the Chinese Communist Party. Statements like, quote, "We should not leave it to politicians, especially not Western politicians, to determine what we think about human rights." And the development of human rights in China should be seen in the context of domestic conditions and not be a copy of the West. Mm. Perhaps even more striking was another professor of on staff, Professor Peter Peverelli, who has also written with defensive tones about China's human rights record, describing the stories of Uyghurs' labor camps in Xinjiang as rumors and saying on LinkedIn, quote, "Xinjiang is simply beautiful, beautiful people, breathtaking nature and good food, and no forced labor, no genocide or whatever lies the Western media come up with." So yeah, two examples there of two professors that really make it look like this department in a Dutch university is employing people and sharing views that would almost certainly please the Chinese government. And when it turns out that the department is actually funded by a university that has strong links to the Chinese government, that has caused quite a stir. Because it's been quite shocking to read about the human rights violations documented in China over the past years. And I would have thought that there would be a pretty clear consensus in European universities anyway, that believed the things that bodies like Amnesty International are saying, that more than 1 million Uyghurs are imprisoned in re-education camps, a figure described by the United Nations as credible as well.
So have these professors actually tried to defend themselves? Seems like a pretty tough challenge.
Yeah, they did try. The director of the department, he did maybe a better job at defending himself. He gave a long interview to the Dutch public broadcaster and said that he does believe that the human rights of Uyghurs are being violated and that if any of the writings from his department's website might coincide with the views of the Chinese government, then that's simply coincidental.
Okay.
The other professor quoted in the article, Peter Peverelli, said that statements on the center's website should not be interpreted as a denial of what is happening in Xinjiang. So they do seem to be trying to backpedal a bit.
And what about the university itself? What have they said about this whole thing?
Well, yeah, this Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam, they initially defended the department as independent and they confirmed that and that was their first statement. But then they released another statement in which they announced a decision to return all of the funding from the university in China that had funded this department since 2018. They acknowledge that even the appearance of a lack of independence is unacceptable.
It's something, I guess. How much cash are we talking about? How much have they actually been getting from this Chinese university?
It's a lot. They were getting between 250 and 300,000 euros each year. And some of those years, it was most of those years, in fact, it was the only source of funding for this department. Mm. And the belief from many China experts is that in exchange, the Chinese state were getting an alternative, more rosy view of their human rights record presented by a respected Dutch university. This is just soft power in action. And it's not the first time that China have been accused of interfering in Western universities. The Free University in Berlin had a similar controversy a few years ago when they accepted a considerable amount of money from a branch of the Chinese Education Ministry. And you also talked a while back about the controversial plans for a new campus in Budapest for the Shanghai-based Fudan University, didn't you?
I did, yeah. And actually, it's not even just in Europe. I watched a really interesting documentary about Chinese influence in Western universities in general the other day. And it talked about a similar kind of scandal at the University of Queensland in Australia.
Yeah, it's a big thing in Australia.
Yeah, huge, because it's, you know, kind of in the neighbourhood and there's like such a huge Chinese-Australian population as well. The film in general was talking about how sort of expat communities around the world are used for this sort of soft power operation. It's a really good doc. I will post a link in the show notes. Weirdly, it doesn't have a single woman interviewed in it, which I felt very distracting. No. But apart from that, very interesting. It's called China's Magic Weapon.
I'll watch it. Because, yeah, clearly the Chinese realize that they have an image problem in the West around human rights. And it seems like their solution at the moment, instead of cleaning up their human rights problems, is proposing an alternative view of what human rights are. And in their version of human rights, it's not necessarily the human rights of the individual that are focused on, but the human rights of society as a whole, thus giving them this weird intellectual space to justify forced labor, for example, to achieve economic growth in society. And using universities for influence can be effective. David Missel, who's a German journalist who specializes in human rights in China and actually studied in China himself, said to the Times a while back that one of the difficulties with the influence China can have on professors is that it's not always in the public eye. He said professors could be censored or practice self-censorship. The fear is especially real for sinologists. If you speak out critically against China, you might not get a visa in the future, or you might be disadvantaged in other ways. This means many simply decide to keep silent. So this bad week for Free University of Amsterdam is yet another concerning story of alleged Chinese interference in Western universities. Probably not going to be the last bad week of this type.
Yay, cheery. Thanks for that. I mean, it's really hard, isn't it? My partner is an academic, and you know, you can see up close, like, universities across Europe are really struggling for funding. So it's not insane that when China, effectively the Chinese state, or a really closely linked organization to the Chinese state, offers them cash, it's pretty hard to say no sometimes.
They can come and... No, they're not going to... They can't come and sponsor the podcast. Please don't. Please don't offer us money. We'll find it very difficult to say no.
Just to clarify, we would not entertain the suggestion.
Sorry, that was a very inappropriate joke. Who's had a good week, Katie?
It's been a good week for a couple living in Italy near La Spezia, which is a lovely town, by the way. I've spent some time there. Why has it been a good week for this couple? Well, they have been fighting a 19-year legal battle over the noisy toilet in the apartment next door to them. Listeners who live in apartments with thin walls will sympathise strongly with this couple, because for two decades, they have been dealing with what they described as intolerable noise from this toilet, which is right on the other side of the wall from their bed. And to make matters worse, apparently whoever was on the other side of the wall was a frequent nighttime toilet user, which is not ideal if said toilet is, right next to your head while you're sleeping. Now, many of us who live in cities simply resort to earplugs while quietly raging at our neighbours.
Yeah.
And none of the news reports about this case that I've read mentioned whether or not the couple had actually tried earplugs. The couple haven't been named in the media, so the facts are a little bit thin on the ground. But you would think that they've tried like various other things before going for the nuclear option and taking it to the courts, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Anyway, suffice to say, this case has been going through the courts since 2003. Initially, the case was rejected. The local court said, like, no, this couple just had to suck it up and deal with the noise. They appealed against that ruling, and then a higher court ordered there to be an investigation. This is one of the, like, the big moments of high drama in the story. They sent toilet experts, or like noise experts, I guess, to investigate what the deal was with the toilet. And the investigators found that the brothers who owned the flat next door, they'd actually knocked a hole in the wall and embedded the water tank of the toilet in the wall, I guess to make it sort of look more stylish on their side, or to save space or something. But that did do a lot to explain why the noise was quite so intense on the couple's side of the wall. It was literally a few centimetres from their headboard.
It's so weird. I just cannot imagine, like, going through a legal proceeding must be so stressful. Imagine deciding it was important enough to keep appealing.
I'm obsessed with the idea of hearing the noise of the toilet. Like, it must be completely insane for them to go this far.
You mean you're telling me you don't have a recording of it for this podcast?
I'm sorry, I don't.
That's very disappointing. But this is good week, so that means they won the case, presumably.
They did win the case. So would you believe it? This went all the way to the Supreme Court of Italy, who have just ruled in the couple's favour. The Supreme Court judges agreed that this noise was intolerable. And the brothers who own the flat next door have been ordered to pay 500 euros in compensation for every year that this toilet has been stopping the couple from sleeping.
Oh,
which
goodness.
In total is like 10,000 euros, because it's 19 years of noise that we're talking about. And of course, the brothers have also been ordered to take the toilet cistern out of the wall.
What were the arguments the court gave when they sided with the couple?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because they actually referred to the European Convention on Human Rights. And they argued that according to the convention, people have a right to exercise their daily habits freely as part of the right to a private life.
So essentially they're saying it's a human right not to have a toilet next to your head?
They are kind of saying that. And this is what I'm wondering. Like, is this going to set some kind of legal precedent for people who are having these arguments with their neighbours every day in cities all over Europe? Myself, for example, my upstairs neighbour in Paris, hello Eve, if you're listening, he's nice and we get on well, but he is an insomniac and he does like walk in circles above my head and sometimes like drop heavy objects on the floor at 3 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the morning. And when he first moved in, we had a fairly robust debate, I'll say. And I was like, come on, you're killing me. Like, you're stopping me from sleeping. I'm having to adopt your insane lifestyle and like be awake when you are, which is all of the time. And because this is France, it got philosophical really quickly. And he was like, well, you're talking about your freedoms being impinged. What about my liberty to enjoy my property? And I'm wondering, like, would the European Court of Human Rights agree whether the exercise of my daily habits was being violated? Because you could argue that he also has a right to enjoy his daily habits.
We all just need to live in better insulated houses.
That is the solution to all of this. The Merkel solution. She was a big fan of insulation. Anyway, I don't have the time or money or desire to take my personal beef with my neighbour to court. So I'm just going to carry on wearing earplugs and leave it at that.
Final question. I'm sorry, I've had so many. But why did it take the court so long to make a decision about this? 2003!
Yeah, well, the Italian courts are famously slow. I think we talked about this before on the podcast when we were discussing the Mafia Maxi trial.
Oh, yeah.
And why it's got this whole speedy trial process. Because it's actually the slowest moving court system in the EU. It takes more than 500 days to get a verdict in the average Italian court case. And then obviously if there are appeals, it's going to take years, as it did in this case. It's actually something that Mario Draghi has said that he wants to change as Prime Minister. But the fact that this toilet trial has taken so long is actually something that's come up in quite a lot of the commentary around this case in the Italian media. One journalist for Il Giornale, a guy called Massimiliano Parente, he pointed out that Einstein actually developed the theory of relativity in less time than it took to get a decision about the toilet case. And I'll just finish on a lovely quote from his very funny column. He wrote, "At the judicial level, we are a big, huge, gigantic, clogged toilet."
It's that time in the show when we shower thanks on the people who have parted with some of their cash to help keep our little podcast baby growing. This week, we'd like to send a shout out to Raf, Jake Douglas, and Anda Huzao.
Thank you guys so much. Any donations, big or small, really help us to keep this show running. And for those donations, there are various rewards, including personalized mini podcasts recorded by Dominic and me for your ears only. You can find out more at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. If you're strapped for cash, no worries. There are other ways to support us, including the newfangled way, which is to leave us a review on Spotify.
I think people can't actually leave a review on Spotify. I think they can only star rate us, actually.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That's what I meant. It's a cool new feature. I still need to get used to it. Why not give us 5 big stars? It makes Dominic feel better about that person who said that we weren't funny. If you live your life outside the Brussels bubble, the news might have passed you by over the last couple of weeks, but the European Parliament has a new president, the centre-right Maltese politician Roberta Metsola. She was elected last week following the very untimely death of the previous president, David Sassoli. He died very suddenly. Metsola is an interesting character, to put it mildly, which I think was reflected in the mixture of news headlines about her. Some of the headlines focus on the fact that Metsola is the youngest ever president of the European Parliament. She's 43. Her predecessor was 65. Some of the headlines pointed out that she is the first woman to lead the parliament in over 20 years. But a lot of the headlines in the national media, where I live in particular, in France, they pointed out that Metsola is very staunchly anti-abortion. She was one of the MEPs who voted at the start of the pandemic against this resolution in the parliament that described abortion as a human right. And there's been quite a strong debate over whether we want someone of these views to be the face of our parliament. She herself has said that her job as president will be to represent the parliament as a whole, and that given that the parliament as a whole is in favour of better protection of sexual and reproductive rights, she will do that. But she's also the symbolic head of the one bit of the EU that directly represents us as citizens. And, you know, even personally, I have to say that my instinct as someone who believes very strongly that women should be able to choose what they do with their bodies, I do find it kind of hard to see someone with these views elected to such an important position. Now, Metzeler's view on this is actually not that unusual for a politician from Malta, because Malta has the strictest abortion legislation in the European Union. That sometimes comes as a surprise to people who've visited the country and found it to be liberal and welcoming in other ways. And in general, it's kind of hard from the outside to understand where this really intense taboo around abortion comes from. But this week, we did want to try a little bit harder to understand that. And we have the perfect person to talk to, Liza Caruana Finkel. She's an academic and activist, a founding member of Vote for Choice in Malta, and a researcher at the University of Liverpool in the UK who studies the stigma in Malta around abortion. Just how strict are the abortion rules in Malta?
Malta actually has one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the world. And within the EU, it is the only country with a total ban. So abortion is criminalized, and it is criminalized in all circumstances. And this means that anyone who has or assists with an abortion risks up to 3 years imprisonment. Then there are also harsher penalties for healthcare professionals. So they risk up to 4 years imprisonment, and they can also be struck off their professional register.
Wow, that sounds like incredibly heavy laws. So Maltese women who do find themselves with unwanted pregnancies, they've tended to have to go abroad for abortion, haven't they? And that's if they can afford it. Has that become harder because of the pandemic?
So I wanted to start by saying that people obviously have abortion for a number of reasons, for unsupportable pregnancies. And some of these pregnancies can actually be very wanted ones, not necessarily unwanted ones. People in Malta have, for a number of years, been accessing abortions in mainly one of two ways. There is the travel abroad, which is the legal options, but there's also abortion pills that are ordered online, which are safe but not legal to take within the country. But obviously, as you mentioned, not everyone can travel abroad, even if that's something that they'd like to do, because financially they might not be able to afford that. Thankfully, for people who do lack financial means, Abortion Support Network, which is an organization based in the UK, has been helping people access abortions for the last couple of years. But of course, there are other barriers to access. So if you have a pregnant teenager, a single mother who does not have any access to childcare, someone living in an abusive setting, for instance, someone with mobility issues, or even asylum seekers who don't have the necessary travel documentation, they all face additional obstacles to be able to travel abroad. Obviously, with COVID-19, things became even more complicated. So in the beginning of the pandemic, there were the travel bans. And so the only legal route to access an abortion, which is by travel abroad, was basically inaccessible or much more difficult for people to access. So more people started to contact abortion pill providers and other abortion support groups. But the issue is that abortion pills can be safely used for self-induced abortion within the first trimester. So people who had pregnancy at a later gestation had even more issues in this case. And with the pandemic, there were issues with these pills even arriving in the country. So there were delays in manufacturing of the medication, delays in the medication arriving by postal services. And then when the flights actually did resume, still things were more complicated. So, you know, flights are more expensive. You have to do lots of tests. But thankfully, Abortion Support Network has been able to help with this as well in terms of not just the financial aspect, but also providing practical help.
I've been trying to understand a little bit about the social taboo around abortion. Like, it really is this incredibly strong social taboo, right? Like, what does the stigma look like in practical terms?
A lot of people don't talk about needing or wanting to access abortions, or even having had abortions if they were done legally, because there's a lot of stigma in the country and there's a fear of potential legal repercussions. Another issue is that there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation on the topic in the country. So people won't know what services are legal, whether the provision of information is legal, for instance, or not. And there are actually no state-run family planning services in the country. So many people are scared about approaching healthcare professionals for help because they don't know whether they'll be shamed or judged or even potentially reported. But thankfully, in August 2020, FPES Malta was established. So FPES Malta is the Family Planning Advisory Service. It isn't state-run, it is actually volunteer-run. And what this service does is they provide unbiased and accurate information on reproductive healthcare, basically. So on contraception, on emergency contraception, on abortion options. And they can also direct people towards pro-choice professionals, such as gynecologists or potentially counselors. So this way, people can know that if they go to a particular gynecologist, they can speak openly about abortion with the person. They won't feel ashamed, they won't be judged, and they won't be stigmatized.
It's great that these organizations exist, but it's sad that they have to exist. And why do you think it is that there is still such a strong social taboo against abortion in Malta?
In Malta, you have very restrictive laws. You have moral conservatism. There is religious legitimation and also certain gendered social norms. So all of these combine and therefore intensify the abortion stigma within the country. Malta is also a majority Catholic country, and Catholicism is actually enshrined into the constitution. Then you also have within schools, for instance, anti-abortion groups are sometimes invited to give talks. Children are still in certain schools shown The Silent Scream, which is an anti-abortion propaganda film from the 80s, which was actually debunked a number of times. There's this idea of sacrificial motherhood within the country. And also Malta is a very small island nation. So there's a few degrees of separation between people. And when a lot of people know each other, it's even more difficult to sort of challenge the status quo. And because most people who have had abortions don't speak about it publicly, I think the public actually thinks that abortion is not as prevalent as it actually is. And maybe like a final thing is that Malta was colonized for a very long time, so it hasn't been independent for that long. And there is this fear of foreign influence, so foreigners imposing their own views upon the country.
Is there any sign that attitudes are changing over time, like a Gen Z, Maltese, young people, any less anti-abortion than the generations before them, or not really?
I think there has been progress. There is more of a discussion on the topic, and I would accredit this partially to the existence of the pro-choice movement, of pro-choice activism, but also to other progressive social legal changes in the country in recent years. And so there was a survey done last year in 2021. They found that there was a relative majority of respondents who actually did not agree with the fact that women should be imprisoned for terminating pregnancies. So I think that attitudes are changing, and I think that a lot has been achieved in a short amount of time in terms of the fact that the pro-choice movement has only been around since 2019, so just under 3 years. But obviously more needs to be done, especially in terms of things like sex education, the provision of accurate information and things like that.
One of the things that I've always found it difficult to get my head around is the fact that Malta has such a good reputation for gay and transgender rights. It actually has topped this Rainbow Europe ranking for the past 5 years. And it seems so counterintuitive to me that the same country would be so supportive of LGBT rights, but have such strong anti-abortion laws. Is there any historical reason for this contradiction?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And I think that's a question that I get quite often. I think that laws do not actually reflect social reality. So just in terms of, you know, LGBTIQ rights, there is still a gap that exists and social change still is needed to bring this in line with legislation. But yes, you're right. So the LGBTIQ movement has for years worked to push for positive social legal changes. And in comparison, the pro-choice movement in Malta is still very new. I also think that there's no political will in terms of abortion. Both main political parties in Malta, so the Labour Party and the Nationalist Party, they have both made anti-abortion statements. The current president has endorsed anti-abortion events, and he's even said that he's part of the group Doctors for Life. You know, being in favor of abortion access is seen as political suicide in a way. Whereas with LGBTIQ rights, politicians might have potentially seen the prospect of gaining votes of the community and therefore pushed for these kinds of changes. I think that abortion is just a much bigger taboo in the country, and it's an issue that has been disregarded for a very long time.
One of the politicians who has found it very advantageous, at least in public, to be very anti-abortion is Roberta Metsola. With your kind of activist hat on, Lisa, rather than your academic hat on, what does it feel like for you to have a Maltese politician who is anti-abortion becoming the kind of public face of the European Parliament?
There's the obvious negative perspective of an MEP who is from a conservative centre-right party who is publicly anti-abortion and has, you know, anti-abortion voting record, becoming the president of the European Parliament. But then you can also perhaps see it from a positive perspective. What I mean here is that it has brought the spotlight back on sexual and reproductive health and rights, including abortion. Roberta Metzola received many questions from journalists, specifically about her stance on abortion when she was elected president. And in her responses, she did insist that as president of the EU, she will take on the parliament stance. It has also brought back Malta on the agenda and highlighted the fact that within the EU, Malta is actually the only state with the total ban and actually has the worst laws. And I think it may have, in a way, created impetus for change. I think that sometimes things sort of need to regress a little bit before there is incentive for change. So when people feel like their rights might be taken away, I think that's when people sort of wake up and react.
Lisa published a great article in The Conversation over the summer about why it is so vital to decriminalise abortion in Malta, which you can find in the show notes. Thank you so much to Lisa for joining us, and also to friend of the show, Meg Clement, for putting us in touch. If you know someone who you think the rest of Europe needs to hear from, we are always really, really happy to hear ideas for guests that you think should appear on this podcast. Ping us an email, hello@europeanspodcast.com. Isolation Inspiration Time. What have you been enjoying this week?
Well, I spent most of my week in the Austrian mountains at a really cool art and architecture biennale. It was the first time I've been like at a proper festival with meeting other people. Also, it was outside, which was insane because it was like minus 10 degrees, but also really COVID safe.
That bit sounds less fun.
Yeah, but when I wasn't looking at interesting art and architecture, I was sticking to my reputation of watching TV series about 2 years after other people have.
Okay.
So I wanted to recommend a Danish series that originally aired in 2020, but in my defense, only more recently started to appear on streaming services in my corner of Europe. It's called The Investigation, and it's a 6-part dramatization of the police investigation into the death of Kim Wall, the 30-year-old Swedish journalist who was murdered in 2017 on a submarine. It's a horrible and tragic real-life story, and this TV series does an amazing job at telling the story of the really complex aftermath of her murder without sensationalizing her death at all, without showing you any gruesome images, and significantly without ever even naming the murderer. They're just referred to as the suspect throughout.
I think that's really good.
Yeah, I think it's really good too. And I was kind of half worried that it was going to mean that it was going to be a really boring series without any of the typical sensationalism of a police procedural. It was going to be boring, but it's not at all. And I think the decision that Tobias Lindholm, the director and screenwriter, made to do this really paid off. He really disliked the media circus that followed Kim's murder, and he was really upset that the murderer's name was mentioned more than Kim's. So he tried so hard to make this respectful series, also in cooperation with her parents. In fact, I read that even their family dog is played by the family dog in the series, which is a really touching detail, I thought. Mm. It's just a really impressive bit of TV. So I really recommend you watch it if it's available where you are. I know in the Netherlands it's on NPO Plus and in the US it's on HBO Max, but I think it's available in other places too.
Mm.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I tried out a new podcast this week. It's called Atlas Linguae? I don't know what it's called. I don't speak Latin. Atlas Linguae, I think. But the name of the show is appropriate because it is a podcast about languages and translation. It's from Accenta Studios, who are a very cool podcast studio based in Paris. They make podcasts in several different languages themselves. And it was brought to our attention by one of our patron supporters who actually features in the latest episode, Federico Gobbo, who is professor of Esperanto at the University of Amsterdam.
The other Amsterdam University.
The other one, yes. Yeah, and I really enjoyed this episode and others in the series. Federico's episode is about whether humans will ever be able to enjoy instantaneous translation with the help of machines, kind of like in Star Trek, you know, when they talk to the aliens and they can just like magically understand each other. And it was a really, really interesting listen. I also really liked the episode about emoji and how they use differently around the world. And to my horror, I found out via this podcast that the thumbs up emoji does not mean what I think it means in every culture. And I would just like to apologize to my Nigerian and Afghan former colleagues who I have been merrily sending thumbs up emojis to for years, several times a day sometimes, with no inkling whatsoever that I was essentially telling them to sit on it.
No way. Oh God.
I'm really haunted by it. Sorry, guys.
For my happy ending this week, I wanted to tell you about some clever biologists at the University of Bristol in England who published a study that argues, among other things, that small gardens are just as important as big gardens when it comes to helping bee communities to thrive.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really nice. Their study found that there was not a clear correlation between the size of the garden and the amount of nectar found in a garden. In fact, they found that there were some small gardens that had way more nectar than bigger gardens. This made me very happy because with a lot of the terrifying news around mass extinctions and climate change, it can feel like we as individuals, mainly with teeny tiny gardens or balconies, if we're lucky, can't do anything to help. And this study just shows that even if we only have a very small area outside to tend for, we really can make a difference. So let's all do some research into pollinator-friendly plants and help those bees out.
I am off to go and say more stupid things in my second language. Do check out the tweet thread of embarrassing things that other people have been saying in their second languages. Some of them are really good. My favourite so far is the person who told a bunch of Spanish school children that he had 26 anuses. Europeans Pod. We're also on Instagram at Europeans Podcast or Facebook under the Europeans Podcast.
We will be back next week. But before we go, I want to thank Katie Lee and Wojciech Oleksiak for producing this show. Thank you, Katie.
You're welcome. Wojciech also says you're welcome. Our other producer is Kat Slazlo. She's off doing some exciting things for later in the year. And we are part of the Are We Europe audio family. Check them out for some more continental ear stuff.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Adios.